Alright, today's date is the 17th. Tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, I suppose, of March 1983. And my name is Chris Bell, and I'm at the home of Air Marshal Dunlap out in Oak Bay. And this is the third interview, I guess, of social life in the Canadian Air Force between the wars. And last day we were talking about Camp Borden. And I believe, sir, you wanted to discuss a particular individual before we continued.
Yes, I think it was the first day we were together, I mentioned a character by the name of Dave Harding. He was a flight lieutenant in the RCF, and a very well-known one. He was the one who was regarded as Canada's outstanding football player of all time when he was at Queen's. And Queen's had the team in Canada in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Edmonton and Eskimos and had not even been thought of at that stage. And he was, of course, a great aerobatic pilot. He was well known across the country for his aerobatics. His first encounter with aerobatics, I shouldn't say the first encounter, but my first knowledge of his aerobatics relates to an incident that took place out in Palestine during World War I. And Dave was, while flying a fighter plane, saw a troop train going across the desert. And he thought these poor troops who were hanging out the window on this stifling hot day need some entertaining. So he put on an aerobatic display at a height of about 15 feet above the ground. Everybody was shouting and cheering and giving him a great hand, but one car on that train showed no interest whatsoever. The windows were open. Obviously people in the car, not taking no interest in Harding, so he decided he'd shake them up a little bit, so he flew by at about the same speed as the train, or as close as he could get to it, and took his very signal cartridge and fired a pyrotechnic cartridge in one window, hoping it would go right through and out the other, but of course, you know what happened. It didn't make a clean passage. And the five cartridges bounced all over the inside of this car. It turned out to be General Allenby's private car in office. Oliver's didn't endear Harding to the general. Well, I mention that only to indicate that Harding was a character, and he was used to lots of adulation and so on. In the peacetime force, he was in great demand for aerobatics at aviation shows, and of course the Air Force put on an annual Air Force Day, and the public was all invited. And
was at Camp Borden,
though? Yeah, at Camp Borden, and Harding would be the star turn, and at the Cleveland Air Races, he would be down there with a Siskin putting on a great show. And I think Dave rather expected that he would sail through the Air Force without too much effort on his part, and however, I'll come back to that later. I just want to mention that he happened to be my immediate predecessor in a guest house that I stayed at when I was at Jericho Beach in Vancouver. Mrs. Phillips was the widow who took us in. She was a delightful old motherly type. And she regularly had letters from Dave Harding, and I should say Dave Harding, I guess, spent two or three months with her before I came on the scene. He was being posted. I arrived, and I just took over his room there. She regularly got letters from Dave's mother. Dave's mother was quite a devout Roman Catholic, and she was always anxious that Dave would be the same and not miss Mass and so on. So she would write to Mrs. Phillips and urge her to see that Dave either saw the priest or went to Mass and so on. But she was never very successful. However, he got the flu on one occasion, and he was confined to his bed, and he wasn't very happy about life. She thought, this might be my opportunity. I haven't been able to get him to go to Mass. I haven't been able to get him to see the priest. I get the priest to come over and pay him a visit while he's in this weak state. So she phoned Father Phelan, who was the local priest. Father Phelan was on his way over when she went up and said to Dave, "Now I've taken things into my own hands and I'm fulfilling your mother's wish, and I've asked Father Phelan to drop in and see you." And he said, "Mrs. Phillips, if Father Phelan enters this room, he's not going to be Father Phelan any longer. He's going to be Father Fallen. I'm going to throw him out the window." He was quite quick witted on it. He was strikingly, ruggedly handsome, and because he was so well known, he was sort of the eligible bachelor in the RCF. The girls fairly threw themselves at him. He spent his time fighting them off.
He was something of a rake, I take it.
No. He wasn't. You might have thought that he was, he sounds a bit like the playboy type.
Mm.
But he didn't drink. Not that he had anything against drink, but alcohol went straight to his brain. He sort of put him off his rock. There must have been a little bit of Indian blood in him or something like that. But he reacted violently, and therefore he was very careful to have no part of it. Now that leads into, I wanted to mention that the next time I encountered him was at Rockcliffe in the mass there. I think this would be in the early 30s. I was there as an instructor on the photographic survey courses, and happened to be there over the, our photo courses generally started in January, ran through January, February, and into March.
Mm-hmm.
I was there over the New Year's Day celebration, the New Year's Day, right, celebrations, there always were a lot, particularly in mess life. You entertained on New Year's Day, you entertained the members of other messes, you went and visited members of other messes, and on your own station you visited the sergeant's mess, and the sergeants came and visited the officer's mess. Dave was very popular with the airmen and the NCOs, and some of them went out of their way to see that he got a bit mellow on these occasions if they could, and he always drank ginger ale. Well, on this occasion somebody spiked his ginger ale, he wasn't quite aware of it. And it, as usual, it went right to his head. And when he came back, after 45 minutes with the sergeants, he was really quite inebriated.
Mm-hmm.
And he was terribly upset about it, because he had fallen in love a couple of months before, was having a little difficulty pressing his suit because his intended fiance, or his fiance, I guess I should say, was a Baptist, and he was Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Not only was she a Baptist, but she was the daughter of one of the leading citizens of Ottawa and one of the wealthiest, one of the lumber kings of Ottawa. And the parents were very straight-laced. I think they take a very dim view of their daughter falling in love with Dave Harding, because A, he was Roman Catholic, B, he was in their eyes a bit of a playboy, and C, he wasn't a very good prospect, because I don't think even in 1932 or 31, 32 that an aviation career looked like a very stable and safe
profession.
Yeah.
Was he still flying actively?
Yes. So he had never managed to get inside the household. The parents
wouldn't let him in.
Well, I shouldn't say that. I think he'd been there, but they wouldn't. They didn't recognize him. They wouldn't have him to dinner or anything like that. But finally, this was broken down, and on New Year's Eve, he was to go there to dinner. But on New Year's noon, he was in no fit condition. Well, I was in on this because I happened to be a Baptist myself, and I knew the family.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Dave used to come to me and appeal to me as to how he should press his suit and get around all this. So I was very upset about what had transpired there. Two or three of us got him. It was quite a wintry day with a good wind blowing and drifting snow and so on. We decided, he was a very athletic type, he liked to keep himself in shape, so we decided that he would get his running gear on and go out and run around the perimeter of the airfield, that he might sober up a bit. So we got him off. It was about 1 o'clock in the day. He didn't have many hours to go before he had to appear for dinner. We got him off running around the field, but the perimeter track of the field happened to be the main road that leads down to the hangar area. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a perimeter in the sense that it was a taxiway for aircraft. It was a motorway for cars. And while Dave was running down this road in the poor visibility, motor car came up behind him. Mm-hmm. And the bumper hit him right underneath the back of the knees and sent him up into the air. He did a loop right over the top of that car. He came down on his feet and kept on running. he was as tough as nails. You couldn't injure him in any way.
You saw this happen?
No, but we had a description from the motor car driver. And he kept on running around there. He was not too conscious of what had happened. And he came back in. And when he entered the mess after this long run, and he was looking as hearty and healthy as could be, he had very ruddy complexion. In the anteroom, I haven't told you about that mess in Rockland yet. It had been the farmhouse of that farm area upon which the airfield was built. Mm-hmm. It was a nice old stone structure. The rooms weren't all that big, and the anteroom had a billiard table, and it pretty well filled the room up. There was space at one end, but the rest of the other two-thirds of the room were pretty well filled. And he came in there, and it was a big table. And he saw the leg of that table, and he thought of his old football days, and he took a flying leap, and he tackled one leg of the table.
Did he break it?
He moved that big table about a half or three quarters of an inch, which is a bit of movement. So then we got him in. We got a lot of hot coffee and then we got him in the cold shower. Put him to bed, sent him off. But of course, when he got to, and he went off to fulfill his engagement. But he still was obviously under the influence, and that ended that quest of engagement of his.
Sure.
Which was unfortunate, because she really was a delightful girl, and I was very fond of her. She would have made him a very fine wife, and he went. I don't know whether he ever did get married. He was on the point of marrying a widow with five children at one stage, but I think he thought better of that. And when war came, he was a bachelor all through the war. He became a station commander down in the Niagara Peninsula area. I've forgotten which station it was. Dunville, or one of those. Mm-hmm. Station down, Fine Training School. So he did reach the rank of group captain, but I should say a few things about that. In our younger days in the service, and I'm talking through in my younger days, and I suppose his too, mm-hmm. He was only about 9 years older than I was. We all had to do promotion exams. You didn't get promoted simply on the basis of what the CO thought of you or how you had done your job professionally. Mm-hmm. You had to pass promotion exams, and it involved quite a bit of study and hard work. Mm-hmm. Also, you had to do staff college entrance exams. So you had a fairly heavy study curriculum in your junior years in the service. Now, Dave was always too busy with the more social side of life to find much time for study, and I don't think he was a student anyway. He hadn't done very well at Queen's. So he just didn't get promoted for a long time. Here he was, the senior flight attendant in the Air Force.
Flight attendant when you were there?
Oh, yeah. Well, we were, in this period I'm talking about, he was either a flying officer or a flight attendant. He didn't get promoted to flight attendant until you passed exams, that's right. So he was a long time getting to be a flight attendant. And same thing with squadron leader, you had to be a long time moving ahead. Well, while he was a flying officer, during those days in at Rockcliffe, I remember on occasion of a mess dinner, and the Rockcliffe mess doubled as a headquarters mess as well. The RCF headquarters was in Ottawa, and when the mess dinner took place, if the headquarters wanted a mess dinner, they used the facilities at Rockcliffe. Mm-hmm. I remember on one occasion hearing him tackle the CA, when he wasn't called Chief of the Air Staff, he was called the Senior Air Officer or the Director at various points in our history. And I think it was when J. Lindsay Gordon was the Director of the Air Force. Pinning him down in a corner late after a mess dinner and saying, "Sir, I haven't passed my promotion exams. I haven't been able really to write them because you fellows in headquarters keep putting me on assignments that keep me from studying. You know, I just get to a point where I want to get down to work, and you send me here, you send me there, and you give me a job that requires a lot of contact with the public and so on and so on. I haven't any time to study. I have never had a course in the Air Force, and yet you expect me to pass promotion exams. Everybody else gets training courses, and it helps them on their way to a And finally, he extracted the promise from Lindsay Gordon that he would be put on a course. Well, another year or two went by, and he still hadn't been put on a course, still had promotion exams. He agitated again. And who should wind up as a student of mine in the summer of 1936 after I came back from England? By this time, I had left Photographic Survey. I was now the head of armament training in the armament school and so on. And one of my pupils was Dave Harding. And that was rather unfortunate for Dave because the other five pupils on the course were bright young boys, either fresh from university or fresh from RMC. One of them was a sort of honor winner at RMC, and the other was just got a master's in mathematics, and another one was an absolute wizard student. And
poor old Dave. Dave.
I don't think it helped him too much. And of course, an armament course was not going to help him too much in the matter of promotion exams, because the subjects that you had to study were military history, military geography, and political science and things of that nature, and military law.
Mm-hmm. The kinds of things you need to agree
with. The business of doing a course Dave thought would be very helpful to him. It wasn't particularly. But however, mm-hmm. a war came along.
That
promotion was not so much a...
Well, since we're on the topic of promotion, let me ask you, how do you feel about that system? Do you think it was fair in that someone like Dave, who was a qualified pilot, who knew his job, could do the job, was sort of held back because he didn't have the discipline or the desire to do the, quote, paperwork? And that merit.
Well, by and large, I think it was fairly, it was a fairly good system.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the present-day system is better, where you are detailed, where you're under training practically the whole time you're in the service. You're on administrative courses, or you're being prepared for staff courses, or you're on a staff course,
mm-hmm.
or you're on specialist courses, and so on. I think a planned career is better than leaving it to the individual. You see,
mm-hmm.
here, if the individual was studious and would work hard and apply himself, he had a greater advantage over these other fellows who might be good leaders, who might make good wartime leaders, but probably wouldn't make very good staff officers. Dave Hardy wouldn't have been a staff officer at all. And I can think of many others. I can think of several first-class chaps who are really good leaders, but they would not be good staff officers. If they were good in a field command, in an operational command in the field, they might be very...
But in a small peacetime Air Force, I suppose, they're sort of shut it off to the side almost.
Yeah.
They have to be, I guess, if you want a small professional force.
That's right, yeah. Okay, well, I've taken that amount of time to talk about Dave Hardy because I think it illustrates a little bit the image of the Air Force, the public image of the Air Force in those early days. There wasn't any image. I don't think the public in Canada knew too much about the Air Force, but many of them thought it was a very hazardous occupation.
I think they felt
that the people who were in the service were a very devil-may-care lot.
Well, at this time, weren't there films coming out? Like Wings, I think, was a 1920s
film. Oh, yeah, sure.
The Dawn Patrol.
Yeah. And, of course, the reputation of a lot of the World War I boys was... Understandably, they didn't expect to live very long, and therefore they were going to enjoy life while they had it, and that was the public got that impression of the Air Force.
But for the peacetime forces, it was a distorted image, and
it
wasn't really in keeping.
Yeah.
But I suppose you had the odd fellow like Dave who stood out and sort of caught the public's imagination.
Oh, yes, there were a number of people of that nature. Well, you want to talk something about mess life other than the mess life at Camp Borden. Let me tell you what messes I was associated with, and then you can pick up from there. I had mentioned that after Camp Borden I was in Jericho Beach, and there was no mess life there.
Mm-hmm.
But when I left there, I was posted to... Rockland,
and
Ottawa Air Station, just outside Ottawa. And when I first arrived there, there was no mess life because the station was relatively new. It had been used for a few years prior to this as a seaplane base, but on a rather temporary basis. And therefore, there were no buildings other than hangars there. But then it was developed as both a land plane and a seaplane station, and new hangars were built. And that was the situation when I arrived. There were two, one new hangar. There was another hangar there, but there were two hangars and a little temporary building that served as an office building. And on the, what is now the main side of the field, the upper side of the field, there was one building that had just been constructed, and it was an NCO's mess. And that was the only thing that went by the name of a mess, and really it was so small, and it had the dining room and practically nothing else. And we all ate in that at noonday. We officers lived in the city of Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
We went out to the base under sort of dubious, makeshift arrangements. We would have to go by streetcar, for as far as the streetcar went, and then we were picked up by a lorry and traveled out in the back of a lorry to the base. That was the only means of getting out there.
But how many men were stationed at Rockcliffe?
Rockcliffe would have about... It wasn't a big station in those days, I suppose. There would be about a dozen pilots and 50 or 60 all other ranks, all told.
What period are we talking about now? What year?
This is 1929.
So you weren't at Jericho Beach for very long?
No. That was a brief sojourn at Jericho Beach. I went back there later on, but that was a brief one. So we therefore had a breakfast and dinner in Ottawa, but the luncheon. Say it was in this little building, which was really the sergeant's mess. And the officer's mess was still under renovation, I guess you would be the word to use, because it was being made out of the original farmhouse. Nice, attractive old stone, early limestone structure. Not bigger than, not really much larger than a good sized city home or house. But it did have, it had a good sized living room and dining room, big enough to take care of all the officers there. And in the wintertime when we had a photo course, there was an influx of officers to, for training. I suppose he could handle about 12 to 18 people in the dining room, but no more. That would be a squeeze. It had a nice balcony, a veranda, which added a bit of space to it. And upstairs, there were five or six bedrooms, small. And those were all fully occupied, particularly when we were on course. But that wasn't to be completed for another year. So the next time around when I was at, let me see, I shouldn't say the next time around, but I went off. Rockcliffe was sort of the center of photo operations in those days, and detachments went out from there. So I left there and went off to Nova Scotia for, and up into northern Quebec in the latter part of that year. And when I came back to Rockcliffe, didn't get back till the second or third day of January. We were in the new mess then. So the new mess started from about the latter part of 29. And it was a comfortable little place. It was like living in a small home with about 9 or 10 chaps batching it. But we did have somebody to look after, prepare the food, and keep the place clean one to another. Well, let me see, what can I tell you about? Oh, yeah, I was going to tell you about the various messes I'm in. I shouldn't have got into that. Then, after Rockland went back to Camp Borden for tour duty. After this tour duty in Rockland, of course, I went on to photographic operations all over the country and wound up for several years out here in B.C. But after that, every year, or every second year anyway, I went back to Rockcliffe to give photographic courses. So I kept in touch with that mess down there on these winter intervals. And then along in 1934, I went back to Camp Borden. So I was in the mess life again at Camp Borden in the winter of 34.
Was it the same mess, or had it burned down?
It had burned down. There was a new one. I was going to tell you that. And then, of course, from Camp Borden, after about a year there, I was sent over to the UK on an armament course. And I spent a year at East Church, which was, I guess, the oldest air station in Britain, oldest air base in Britain. It had been one of the early Royal Naval Air Service bases. And then I was married while we were in London and England. So my bachelor days and messes had come to an end, and my married association with messes started from 1936. From there, I went back to Camp Borden again for a year, and then back to East Church for a year. So I had a couple of tours of associations with that East Church mess. One is a bachelor officer living in bachelor's quarters, and the other is a married officer. And then, of course, we moved the school, the armament school moved from East Church up to Lincolnshire to a brand new station. So I had a life in the UK, a new UK station and Mass. Mm-hmm. And then back to, from there to Ottawa, to Air Force headquarters. That's when I was first posted to headquarters. So that gives you a little inkling of the various associations I've had with Mass life in the early part of my career. So if there's any particular period of that or area of that you want to explore,
mm-hmm.
Let's do so.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Rockcliffe, because
right.
You seem to have spent quite a bit of time there.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, all right.
Did it differ greatly in customs, regulations to Camp Borden, and what outstanding features did it have?
Well, no, I wouldn't say it did differ greatly in customs or regulations.
Were most customs and traditions consistent with most RCAF messes?
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't like regiments having different toasts, different this
or
that.
No. The Air Force wasn't structured that way at all. And then the customs would be really identical,
mm-hmm.
practically identical. The games would be the same, and the practices at mess dinners would be the same.
I suppose it was the nature of the service, wasn't it? You didn't really have set squadron.
No,
that's
right. Yeah. I can remember some of those mess dinners at Rockcliffe. Let's see if I can pick out a point in time. I recall one very well when it was really a headquarters mess dinner, but those a number of the people on base and living in mess attended that mess dinner. Therefore, the participants were largely senior officers of headquarters and one or two guests from the local military community. And on this occasion, it happened to be midwinter. And on a very, very cold night, and just about the time dinner was to be announced, cocktail hour had almost terminated, the chef came in and to the PMC in great agitation to say that the power had failed, and all the cooking was done by electricity. And it wasn't possible to proceed to the dinner until the power came back on. Probably would have been wise to proceed with it as was, but chefs don't like to do things like that, so he requested permission to delay until the power came on. Well, of course, the power failures don't always come back on quickly.
So the cocktail hour...
Half an hour passed, and still the cocktail hour is running in another... That was one of the most hilarious mess dinners I've ever encountered. Power did come back on. But the party went on and on and on. And the temperature got down to about minus 40 that night. And this was before the days of strap heaters and the outside plug-in points as you have in Ottawa. In a parking lot there now, you'd be able to plug your car in when you went in on a cold night to spend the night at frolicking like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you came out, you'd be able to get your car started. It was very difficult to get the car started. I remember N.R. Anderson. He became Air Vice Marshal Anderson and head of maritime operations down the East Coast during the war. Very formidable looking type. The fellow coming out there and just being quite unable to start that car. He wasn't too sure what he was doing anyway. But fortunately, Rockcliffe mess was up on a elevated escarpment, I guess you would call it, and everything sloped down from it, and we younger fellows managed to get him pushed to the extent that he could run down this hill. And this applied not only to Anderson, but to three or four others. We had to push to get out of that situation. The I can't remember too much about the what happened at the dinner itself. And that may have been also caused by that prolonged
Do you recall what the chef was serving?
No, I can't. Another dinner I remember some years later at that mess, and this is when I was, this would be about 19, this would be the summer of 39. I was then myself an officer on headquarters staff. And it was the headquarters mess dinner being held at Rockland. Croyle was the, what was then called the senior air officer. I think, well, maybe he'd become, it was in 1939 that they changed from that terminology to chief of the air staff. Mm-hmm. Maybe he had become chief of the air staff. But at any rate, he was in charge. He was the senior. Croyle had always been rather straight-laced.
Well, you had known him at Borden, didn't you?
Yeah, he'd been the CO at Camp Borden when I was there. He didn't approve too much of rowdy activities and drink. And he tended to be somewhat of a dampener at mess parties. But this was rather a special dinner because I remember my boss, Bredner, was there. Bredner later became a chief of the air staff. He succeeded Croyle during the war years. And Gus Edwards was there. He, let me see, and Stedman, all those old-timers, heads of departments and so on. But as guests, I can recall a couple of outstanding guests from Montreal. One of them was Billy Bishop. Billy Bishop in those days was the head of McCall. No, I shouldn't say the head, but he was in the senior appointment of McCall Frontenac Oil Company in Montreal. Frank McGill, who was the... By this time we had formed auxiliary squadrons in the Army. They would call them reserve squadrons.
Mm-hmm.
Weekend soldiery, so to speak, and Frank McGill was... who was a very well-known person in Montreal and had been an Olympic athlete in more than one capacity. He was the CEO of the Auxiliary Squadron and a delightful fellow. And I think one or two of the Foss brothers, who were also members of his squadron, were at that dinner. Owen and the brother. I think I sat that night alongside old Colonel Sparling. I don't know who invited him, but he was the father of chap who was my opposite number when I was vice chief of the air staff. His son, General Sparling, was vice chief of the general staff. Well, by this time, the mess at Rockcliffe had grown. As the years passed, there were additions made to it. It was too small as the station developed. And there was a large anteroom added to replace that initial. And that room, the billiard table had been moved out of the small anteroom, which now became a lounge and reading room, over into this bigger room. And it was quite an attractive room, a big chandelier on top and a large stone fireplace at the end. And big enough that you could have the billiard room down at one end and left room for fun games at the other. And after the dinner, after the speeches were over, one thing or another, Croyle got a game of skittles started on the billiard table, and he and Billy Bishop and Bredner and Gus Edwards and one or two others were playing this game of skittles. So that's a game that's not really quite in keeping with mess games. It was too slow and too quiet. And it wasn't quite suitable to Billy Bishop's temperament either. Or to Bredner's.
They're both fiery types.
Yeah. And Bishop had, was not one to be segregated with the non-drinkers. So we, younger lads, got a game of Buck Buck. I think I talked to you about Buck Buck and High Cock Alarm the last time. Buck Buck and High Cock Alarm, incidentally, I think are the same game, but they go by different names in the UK and in Canada. But
what was the second High?
High Cock Alarm.
High Cock Alarm.
I think High Cock Alarm is a... I can't be sure of this. I was going to say that was a Canadian name, but it sounds more like the British name.
It does, yeah.
And
Buck Buck sounds awfully Canadian.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but again, Buck Buck finally got started, and this was intentional. Yeah, I think the younger elements took a dim view of this quiet game going on. And we got a little noisier, and there was one game of Buck Buck, and finally somebody was, one team was collapsed, and then was another. And when you collapsed, you changed
sides,
and other sides. Collecting the team. And you can see Brad Bredner and Billy Bishop started looking a little gazing longingly at this. Mm-hmm. And they were both fairly sizable by this time. Billy Bishop had been very slight as a young man, but he'd put on weight. Bredner was always a quite big fellow. And finally, at one point of the game, I happened to be looking in that direction. I saw both of them put their cues down. They must have had a word one with the other. Mm-hmm. And they came over and one team was holding, and the team on their backs was almost tottering them.
Sure.
Along came Bredner. He was the first one, and he leapt away in the air, and he landed his skew, and he skewed that whole thing over. He must have weighed about 230 or 240 pounds.
Good Lord.
And as he did, his mess kit, and those mess kits were very rugged, it was split from the crotch right down, almost to the ankle. Well, there was a great laughter about and glee about this, and of course the party went on, and it was a fairly late party before it broke out. Brad went home and put his mess kit away and completely forgot about this. But one of his members of his staff, and actually my opposite, the fellow who I was relieving at headquarters, He was in charge of armament, and I was to take over from him. And we were sharing the same suite of rooms in downtown Ottawa. He was to be married, and Bredner was going to be. He was the Royal Air Force officer on exchange to Canada, and Bredner was officiating at the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, we always worked on Saturday morning, you know. Saturday morning was a working day. The wedding was Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
Not leisurely the way things are these days, but nobody works on Saturday morning. And Brad didn't get away from the office until about 1 o'clock. Or perhaps Brad didn't get home about 1:30. By the time he'd had his luncheon and went up to put on his full dress uniform. And the mess kit trousers are worn with full dress uniform. They served
double purpose.
Took this thing out, suddenly discovered that he was slipped from one end to the other. And the wedding was about 2:30 or 3, something like that. It was a really a very great crisis that suddenly appeared.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the tailors in those days worked on Saturdays too, so he phoned me, he phoned George Preston. George Preston made all the uniforms, all the really good uniforms for the service in that Ottawa area. And he explained his predicament, and George Preston said, well, get yourself ready for the wedding. The wedding was beyond Preston's. Come in here, I'll stitch you up, and you can go from here on to the wedding. So that was the way he got through that crisis and got there just the crucial... crucial moment. Let me see. John Easton was the name of the RAF officer. We had a John Easton in the RCAF as well, but this was John Easton, RAF.
Mm-hmm.
He was as happy as getting married, and he was marrying the niece of Grattan O'Leary. Grattan O'Leary's name may not mean anything to you, but Grattan O'Leary was, I suppose, the Dalton Camp, of that period. Well, he was a good deal more than that, than Dalton Camp. He was the, I guess he had been the president of the Conservative Party at various times, and he was the heart and the brain of the operation, and a terrific orator, a great fellow.
Was he like?
He was the editor of the Ottawa Journal.
Did he support Bennett, or was he against Bennett? Because that was Camp's main drawing card, I suppose. It was his attacks on Diefenbaker.
Yeah. Well, no, there wasn't anything of that involved in it. I don't know whether he supported Bennett or not. He would support him because he was a conservative, I guess. But I don't think he would necessarily go along with all of the policies of the Bennett government. But at any rate, he was a staunch conservative and a brilliant fellow, a great speaker, and wrote remarkable editorials in the journal. I got to know him fairly well then, because he would invite periodically, maybe once a month, John Easton and his fiance into Sunday afternoon tea at his home in Rockcliffe, and I was generally along on these occasions. So it was a wedding of. It was an event in Ottawa, that wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So Brad had to be there properly dressed. He made it.
Well, let me lead you into something else. You mentioned politics with your friend there. What was the prevailing political view of officers, and was there a political awareness of officers at the time? Or did you feel you were apart from politics?
Well, officers in those days took no part whatsoever in politics. It was taboo. You didn't even discuss politics. You were non-political.
Even outside of the mess.
That's right, yeah. You could if you wanted to do so outside of the mess, but it generally wasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this business of Russian here. Your member or your minister was absolutely taboo.
Mm-hmm.
There was no contact whatsoever. In the modern era, seems to be no hesitancy about doing that. In those days, it just wasn't done. You didn't write to your minister and complain about not being promoted, as sometimes happens today. I suppose most of the personnel in the service had been, certainly their families were very political, and growing up in these families, they would have inherited some fairly strong political views, but it was suppressed while you were in the service.
One reason I ask that is that Mackenzie King was leader of the Liberal Party at the time, and he was against any military expenditures, and when he was in power, he cut back until I guess the late 30s, when he was forced to start arming again because of what was happening in Europe. But Bennett didn't seem quite as vocal in his outbursts against the military, and I was wondering if this
you should bring that up, because it was Bennett and his government who really cut the services to the bone.
Yeah,
it wasn't Mackenzie King.
But that was his
necessity. Bennett was out of office.
Mackenzie
King was out of office when this great slash took place. He was in power in 1929 during the crash, the market crash. But as you know, there's a great inertia in the economic and financial world, and it took another year or two to get to the depths of the depression.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, Bennett had come into power. Even in 1930, in 1930, the appropriations for 30-31 were increased rather than decreased.